Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The President's Deficit Commission is all over the news these days, even though it is not itself expected to muster the 14 votes needed to put its big plan before Congress. But it has, say co-chairs Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, succeeded in putting the issue squarely on the table and before the American people. So is this the way, the time, the plan to get it done? This hour On Point, we're asking yay or nay on this whack at the deficit. You can join the conversation. How would you vote? Is this the right approach, the right moment, or not? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter at Facebook at On Point Radio. Let us know your city and state when you comment online. There has been a lot in the news this week on this front. Here's a little bit from Erskine Bowles, former chief of staff for President Clinton, co-chair of the deficit, President's Deficit Commission, saying the deficit must be a priority now.
There's no turning back now. The era of debt denial and the denial of its consequences are over. Together, I think we have started an adult conversation that will dominate the debate until the elected leadership here in Washington does something real.
And there has been some buy-in. Here's Republican Senator Judd Gregg, Republican New Hampshire, at a press conference yesterday, alongside Democratic Senator Kent Conrad, explaining why he plans to vote for the proposal.
The proposal that's been put together here is not the total solution. It has many items in it which I have great concerns about. But it is a very strong, substantive, and serious step down the road towards getting our fiscal house in order.
There, Judd Gregg saying, okay, I'll do it. Not everybody was on board. Here's Jan Schakowsky, a Democrat of Illinois, rejecting what was put forward, concerned that cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and other programs would hurt already vulnerable Americans.
We're going to see programs cut that help to address the problem of those people who have not been part of the party that the wealthiest Americans have benefited from over the years. And so I cannot support this proposal.
And some buy-in, but also resistance you'll hear on the Republican side. Here's Republican Congressman Jeb Hensarling, leader of the conservative sort of wing of the commission, saying he's willing to compromise, but really not sure.
I'm willing to put defense on the table. But again, and I don't want to see any tax increases, but if they're on the table, health care has got to be on the table.
So is this it? Is this time? And is this the plan? Joining us now from Washington, Steve Pearlstein, Pulitzer Prize-winning business columnist for The Washington Post. Steve, great to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Washington, Diana Furstgott Roth joins us. She's the former chief of the Council of Economic Advisors for President George W. Bush, now a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and the Hudson Institute and contributing editor to Real Clear Markets. Diana Furstgott Roth, thank you for being here.
It's great to be with you. Thanks so much for inviting me.
And from New York, Robert Kuttner is with us, founding co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, senior fellow at the think tank Demos, which, along with other progressive groups, released a quite different deficit reduction plan this week. Bob Kuttner, welcome to you.
As always, a pleasure, and thanks for having me, Tom.
It's great to have you. Steve Pearlstein, first to you. Here you are in the press, but a columnist. You've got some attitude. You've got some outlook, and you've been writing the last few days that this is a bold plan, that it's not only credible, your words, credible, fair, and economically sound. You say it also reflects the kind of political and ideological compromise that's no longer part of the Washington skill set. It sounds like you'd vote for it, Steve. Let's just start there.
Yes, I'd vote aye. I have my own plan. It's not exactly the same. But if I had to do an up or down vote on this, I'd vote it aye.
And why?
Well, let me put it in a political context rather than totally an economic one. There's only two possibilities here that I would say to those who are going to vote no or who would vote no. One possibility is that they're just posturing, that they know there's going to be a deal and they just want to get the deal to be a little more like they want it to be. Okay? Well, in that's the case, you should consider their comments as just that, posturing. The other possibility is that they, in fact, would rather have no plan than this plan. And they would do that in the hopes that they would hold out so that their side could win. That's economically dangerous fantasy. It's fantasy because it's never going to happen. Neither side is going to win. Just look back over the last 25 years, and you'll see the plenty of evidence why neither side will win this if they don't compromise. The second problem is that it's going to be economic disastrous. The boost that would come from passing this, that would, in terms of consumer confidence, investor confidence, global confidence, the sense that we finally have a political structure that works, that would be so much greater than, in terms of short-term economic impact as a boost, a stimulus to the economy, than the Republicans think will come from giving tax breaks to rich people, or that Democrats think will come from adding another $100 billion in spending stimulus.
So let me ask you this, if I may, Stephen. I mean, there's not even an expectation now of the 14 votes within the commission that would put it before Congress and require a vote. But Alan Simpson says this thing's going to be shoved into a coffin, but it will rise again, probably next year, and will be back on the table. Do you believe that? Is there enough urgency, and is there enough political support for the basic bones of this that something like it will be back on the table? You think it should. Will it?
Only if President Obama embraces it, is willing to go against leaders of his own party in Congress, embrace it and make it his crusade. In that case, not only did I think it can and will be put on the table again, but it will succeed.
Diana, let me turn to you. You've got a conservative perspective here. You're saying, wait a minute, there's still too much spending and there's still too much taxing in this plan. Would you vote for it?
Well, I would. I certainly think it's better than the status quo, and I'd like to commend all the members of the commission for having got together and put this through. But it does increase taxes by about $900 billion over 10 years. I think that those tax cuts, I think taxes should remain the same. I don't think we should be raising taxes, and I think there are other places where spending could be cut. Furthermore, in terms of reducing entitlements, to say, for example, that individuals and providers should take responsibility for keeping Medicare costs down just loses sight of the main problem with Medicare, that it's basically open-ended, and it needs to be completely restructured.
If you've got those reservations, are you saying you would sort of hold your nose and vote for it anyway? And if so, why?
First of all, whether any of the commission members vote for it it's not completely relevant because it has to go before Congress. Congress has to debate it. Congress has to pass it. Whether it's passed by the commission or not passed by the commission is really not relevant to whether it is going to be taken up.
But I'm asking you, let's say you were in Congress. You're sitting there and it's before you. Just imagine it. Would you vote for it despite your reservations? And why?
I probably would vote for it because it's better than the status quo, but I would have very strong reservations, the reservations being the increases in taxes and the lack of certain cuts that I think should be made. But what we have right now in terms of the current fiscal path is completely unsustainable. The commission has to be commended for making a start in looking at the complete budget picture. But if we look at something like Paul Ryan's Roadmap for America, it keeps taxes low. It makes far more substantive cuts in terms of entitlements and discretionary spending. And this is the debate that Congress needs to be having next year. The commission has made a good start. There are other plans out there, such as Congressman Ryan, and he's going to be chairman of the House Budget Committee next year. Mm-hmm. And the debate needs to happen, and we need to move forward, in my view, not raising taxes and cutting spending more. And anyone outside Washington can, share the belief that there's too much government spending here.
Robert Kuttner, all right, there's Stephen Perlstein, there's Diana. Nobody here has got a vote, but all Americans are thinking what they would do if they had one. We've got two saying yay. You're out with a plan that goes in a different direction this week, Bob. What do you say to what's on the table here?
Well, I think it addresses the wrong problem. The deeper problem is that the economy is in a dire recession that really has many of the dynamics of a depression. And whether the deficit is down to a sustainable level, whether the debt ratio is down to a sustainable level 10 or 20 years from now, is primarily a function of whether we get a strong recovery going, not a function of what budget cuts we extract. And if you tighten the noose too soon, if you pursue an austerity program too soon, you're going to make it much tougher ever to get the deficit or the debt down. I mean, imagine Franklin Roosevelt in 1945 when you have 12 million returning GIs and everybody wondering, what are these people going to do for a living and how do we avoid falling back into the Great Depression? Imagine Roosevelt appointing a commission asking the question, well, what do we do about the economy? Mm-hmm. And the Solons come back and say, the single most important issue is what's the debt to GDP ratio in 1965? I mean, that would have been delusional. And I think by the same token, it's delusional to focus on the deficit as the paramount problem rather than the recovery as the paramount problem. And the idea that cutting the projected deficit, which is really a function of the recovery as much as the spending cuts, focusing on that and assuming that somehow businesses that are reluctant to invest because they don't see people buying products will somehow get such a boost to confidence that that by itself will generate a recovery. I just think that's wrong-headed economics.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the President's Deficit Commission, their big plan to cut American debt and deficit, its priorities, and how you would vote if you had a vote. Stephen Perlstein is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning business columnist for The Washington Post. Robert Kuttner is here, founding co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, part of a group with Demos, the Economic Policy Institute, and others who have their own progressive deficit and stimulus plan on the table this week. Diana Ferscott-Roth is with us from Washington. She's former head of the Council of Economic Advisors to President George W. Bush, now a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, the Hudson Institute, writes at Real Clear Markets. You could hear commission members yesterday going back and forth, wanting to do it, having reservations, and yet saying yesterday we need some kind of plan. Here's Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, saying he could accept some compromises on Social Security to move the process forward.
I'm going to say something now that is heretical on the left, and they won't like me for saying it. But what you have suggested in increasing the Social Security retirement age is acceptable to me. To raise it 1 year over 40 years is hardly radical. To raise it 2 years over 65 years is not radical. These things are sensible, and we've got to accept sensible alternatives to move forward on the left and on the right.
Sensible, said Dick Durbin, though it's not clear where his vote falls yet. Also yesterday, Senator Tom Coburn, Republican, Oklahoma, held back on giving any definitive yes or no, but emphasized the urgency for some resolution.
This plan is a plan. The people have worked on it, have struggled to try to build a consensus. I have heartaches with tons of it. But I know we have to go forward.
Robert, Bob, Diana, Stephen, let's hear from our listeners. Kyle in Hartford, Connecticut. Kyle, you're on the air. What do you think?
Oh, hi. Thank you. I think that it's silly to think that we can take anything off the table. And I think I would vote for this plan right now, partially because it seems like everybody's a little unhappy with it. It seems to me that just by looking at the numbers, you cannot cut spending and solve this problem, and you cannot simply raise taxes and solve this problem. There has to be a combination of the two. The pain has to be shared. And frankly, I would like to know where the political leadership and the courage is in our elected officials to step forward and say to the American public, this will be hard. You will have to sacrifice. We all are going to have to do this together. And accept the fact that these things can't all be sacrosanct. Something has to be given up.
You know, we're hearing that message now. We're hearing it this week that this will be hard. But what about Bob Kuttner's argument, Kyle, that this is not the time? It's like FDR going for austerity just when the country, you know, needed more gas.
The plan isn't to make all these changes tomorrow. The plan is to phase these things over, like they said, raise the Social Security age a year over 40 years. That's not going to affect us tomorrow.
Yeah, but the deficit trimming kicks in pretty quick here. Kyle, we've got your overall, you know, word for it there. But Steve Perlstein, in this plan, it does start pretty quickly in going after the deficit, does it not?
Well, they made some adjustments to that in the revision that came out just the other day. We have this – one of the things, Tom, that you have to be careful about is this bad assumption that you hear or that you would take from a lot of the conversation in Washington, that there's about three or four dials here in a secret room in Washington. And if you just turn those dials just right, then the economy will be fixed. And one of those dials is taxes, another is spending, another is monetary policy, a few others. And it's a false notion of the economy.
Well, you're kind of going after the let's stimulate view
there. These things that people say government has to do or can't do, you know, they do have an effect. But they don't have the effect that they suggest by their rhetoric and by the loudness of their rhetoric. They will have a small effect, and they could get overcome by something happening that is outside of our control, like a European debt crisis, could swamp these things. So people, when they hear these things, should just understand that we don't control things here in Washington. It's a big, complex global economy. Second thing I have to say in response to Bob, this is not the Great Depression. Okay, there are very industrial countries in Europe, and I'm not saying this because I think 9% employment is acceptable. It is not. But there are countries in Europe that lived with 9% employment and slow growth for decades recently. And it doesn't mean the end of civilization. So the notion that we just have to do something now because everything is going to tumble into the Great Depression, it's not true.
Let me pick it up with Bob Kuttner, if I may. Bob, you hear a caller, Kyle, saying, you know, he's ready to suck it up, to see everybody suck it up and act. That, to him, is appealing. Steve Perlstein, you know, saying, well, you may want more stimulus, but there's no guarantee that any particular dial you turn is going to fix this. What do you say, Bob?
Well, first, let me say to Kyle, the pain doesn't have to be shared. There are tens of millions of people in the United States who've already suffered a tremendous amount of pain. And bonuses on Wall Street are bigger than ever. So if the pain is going to be shared, it needs to be shared in a very different way. Secondly, in response to Steve, the fact that there are countries that live with 9 or 10% unemployment for a long time doesn't make it a good thing and doesn't mean that you can't do something about it. And when I say the dynamics are similar to those of the Great Depression, I'm referring to the fact that we have a deflationary meltdown in housing prices. Housing prices were going back up again. Now they've been going down for three straight months. They're projected to decline again. This is the biggest single asset of the middle class. It's an immense drag on the economy. The banking system is still wounded. Interest rates are nominally dirt cheap, but businesses aren't buying, borrowing. Mm-hmm. The banks are hesitant to lend to all but the blue chip borrowers. This is very serious. And the idea that the only thing we can think to do, because you can't twiddle the right dials, is to cut deficits in a way that's going to increase belt tightening, which is going to reduce demand and make recovery harder. I just think that's perverse.
Let me hold the thought right there and get another call. Neil in East Hampton, New York. Neil, you're on the air.
I think the whole thing is kind of oxymoronic, and I agree with Bob completely, that you have a major problem in the country. And the problem is that over the last 30 years, you've had massive income redistribution. And there's probably between $3 and $4 trillion that left the middle class and went to the top 1% of the country. And you look at corporate profits, they're gigantic, as high as they've ever been in the history of the country, and there's no job creation. So your real issue here is not about deficit reduction. It's about how you create jobs and how you bring the middle class back to life, because America's middle class is dying. And when you talk about the Great Depression, this is what you're really talking about. It's the end of middle-class America. The national debt, when Reagan came in, was $4 trillion. It's now $69 trillion, and that's your problem.
And there's the call from the Hamptons. Diana, what do you say to that? The concern about income distribution, the plan that Bob Kuttner and others are putting out this week says, hey, let's do more taxation, and let's do it on the top of the income pyramid that's been richly rewarded in recent decades. What about that focus? What about this plan when it comes to how our wealth is shared, Diana?
I think it's absolutely right that job creation is the major problem that we have right now. And that's why I'm unhappy with the Deficit Commission's recommendation to increase taxes by $900 billion over the next decade. But we need to be focusing on how we create jobs. If we just look at what's went on in Washington this week, President Obama's oil drilling ban, which is costing hundreds of thousands of jobs in the Gulf area and elsewhere. If we look at how Obamacare was structured, beginning in 2014, if a firm with more than 50 workers and doesn't have the right kind of health care, the right kind of health insurance, hires another worker, that's $2,000 per worker per year. So moving from 50 workers to 52 workers in a firm costs the firm $44,000. So every company with 48 workers is saying, I'm not going to hire more than two. Anyone with 55 or 60 is trying to figure out how to get rid of 5 or 10 before 2014. This is just no way to create jobs. I would disagree with the increased income inequality when you take into account tax payments on the top and transfer payments on the bottom. Inequality isn't that much different from the way it was about 20 years ago. And one of the things we could do to reduce income inequality is mandate that women don't work, because one thing we've seen since the 1980s is women move into the workforce. We have more dual income couples. That adds to income inequality. But what we need to do is worry not so much about income inequality, but how people get jobs, how they move up. And an unemployment rate of 9.6% is completely unacceptable.
Steve Perlstein,
that stops mobility.
If I may, where do you see the jobs coming from in this whole picture? Bob Cutner's group, and we'll put the plan up at our website, onpointradio.org, says let's invest more in infrastructure for jobs. Diana's saying, you know, let's keep taxes down to encourage job growth. What about the plan on the table? And then those two perspectives on either side of it, Steve.
Well, I happen to agree with Bob that we need major new investments over time. We do that with borrowed money, like any company borrows money and makes investments, and the return on investment is larger than the cost of borrowing the money, which, by the way, is very low right now. We should be doing lots of that, and there's lots of public investments we should be doing, and we should be giving tax breaks to businesses to encourage private investments, and we should do these things now because it's a good time to do it, both because the economy has lots of slack in it and because the cost of borrowing is low. Diana makes this point, which the Republicans think is self-evident, that is actually economic bunk. If you raise taxes in a $15 trillion economy by, she said, $900 billion, that's over 10 years, so that's $90 billion a year, and actually starts on average less than that, so maybe it starts at $50 billion. If you were to raise taxes in 2 years at $50 billion on a $15 trillion economy, it would have virtually no effect that you could measure. Okay? So the notion that a tax increase is going to hurt the economy is just false economics. It matters how it's spent. If you take $50 trillion from rich people, for example, and invest it in high payoff infrastructure projects or energy projects, in fact, you could have higher output. On the other hand, if you throw it down a rat hole, it would be negative. So the idea that we know what happens when you increase taxes on basically rich people and corporations by $50 billion a year in a $15 trillion economy, that this is the worst thing that could happen in the world, it's just nonsense.
But $900 billion over 10 years is not that much, I suppose, either when it comes to deficit cutting with the scale of
well,
the deficit.
But look, the proposal cuts many, many, many times that more in terms of spending cuts than tax increases.
That's true, including public broadcasting for a little.
I would agree that you know, there's a sort of 70-20 split in terms of tax, 70% in the plan, 70% of the savings or whatever comes from spending cuts and 20% comes from tax increases. I think that's a little imbalanced myself, given as what Bob said, given the rise in income at the top, we could probably do better than that. By the way, I do know my math, 70 plus 20 doesn't add to 100.
Right.
The next 10%, and this is very indicative, Tom, the 10% that is saved at the top comes from interest payments that we won't have to make because we reduce the deficit. That's how big the deficit is.
We can cheer for that. Diana, I'll come to you.
Well,
let me get one call here.
We've just taken $812 billion in stimulus over the past 2 years and spent that. We have unemployment at 9.6%. It clearly has not fixed the economy. To say that the federal government has the power to direct these investments in such a way that it improves the economy, that, I would say, is bunk, given our experience over the past 2 years.
I mean, of course, we've done it ever since the days of George Washington. But let me hold that there. Christina in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Christina, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to circle back to a comment that one of your panel made earlier about 9% unemployment being very common in industrialized European countries and that people get by just fine. My point would be that...
Well, that's not what I said, though.
Well, okay. let's hear Christina out, then we'll come to you, Steve. Yes, Christina.
My point would be those countries also have incredibly robust social programs.
Right.
Those countries have very low financial aid loans and debt for their young people, whereas here in the United States, we have incredibly high debt for young people in terms of their educational loans.
Sure.
When people are not working, they are supported very well, both in health, in terms of health care, in terms of economic payment. So that would be my biggest thing in terms of maintaining a 9% unemployment rate is that a lot of people out there are suffering. People who have done what they were supposed to do in terms of furthering their education have no way of repaying that debt.
So we start from a different baseline than Europe, and we've got that, Christina. But Bob Cutner, let me bring that to you. I mean, a lot of what Europe has done in any number of countries there now is really under pressure. I mean, the UK is cutting back, never mind Ireland and Greece and maybe Spain and Portugal. People point to that model, and everybody would wish for perhaps the comfort of it, but is it feasible in this, sort of comeuppance time?
Well, you're asking a complicated question. Europe has had a much better fiscal picture than we have. They have much more generous social benefits, but generally they pay for them. Europe made the mistake of importing toxic financial products from the United States, subprime loans, credit default swaps, collateralized debt obligations. All that exotic garbage crashed Europe's economy. And then small peripheral countries like Ireland made the further mistake of basically nationalizing bank debt. And the proof of the pudding that austerity doesn't work is the fact that the more these countries tighten their belts, the more international investors look at their bonds and they say, oh, my God, that country's going down the drain. Why should I buy their bonds? It's also complicated by the euro. I just wanted to make one other quick point. Steve's right. We need more infrastructure investment. But I don't see how you reconcile that reality with a vote for the commission report, which would undermine the public resources necessary to invest in infrastructure, in 21st century energy, in research and development, in education. It just cuts the stuffings out of social investment that would actually make the economy more efficient. So if that's what one believes is good economics, why vote for the plan?
It caps government spending ultimately at 21% of GDP. Where would you put it, Bob?
Well, I'd put it at about 24%, but I'd pay for it. I mean, I think where we all agree is that over the long term, the deficit needs to come down. But my view is you get the deficit ratio down by getting recovery going fast, and then more people are working and more people are paying taxes. And that's what happened in the 25-year boom after World War II. The idea that business people and consumers are sitting around and reading this report and saying, wow, it cuts the deficit to just 1% by 2025. I'm going to go out and start a business. I'm going to go out and increase my purchases. That's just delusional. That's not how people make economic decisions.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the President's Deficit Commission, their big plan to cut American debt and deficit, its priorities, and how you would vote if you had a vote. What do you think? Are you watching Ireland, Greece, Spain, Portugal, wondering if we're next? Have Simpson and Bowles got the balance right, the timing right, or not? What's it mean if the commission itself won't vote for this plan. With almost 10% unemployment, is this the time or not? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Stephen Pearlstein is with us from the Washington Post. Robert Kuttner, founding co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, is here. And Diana Furstgott-Roth is with us. She was head of the Council of Economic Advisors for President George W. Bush. You can join us as well. And a lot of people are online. Lots of comments here. Lynn says, good enough. Have to start somewhere. Time for change. Cheryl says, we idolize the greatest generation, and yet we are unable to give up a thing for the benefit of the long-term health of this country. She's got more to say. You can see it on Facebook. We've got a young listener here. Syed says, all these cuts are going to affect the younger generation. The baby boom generation spent decades supporting illegal wars and deregulation. Now, conveniently, they're willing to propose cuts for the future that won't really affect them, but will affect us. And then here's Johan, looking on from Canada, Ontario, saying, oh, America, sadly, the only democracy where a plan to cut health care and education funding while giving millionaires another tax cut is a politically viable solution. Just a taste there. Bethany in Clarksville, Tennessee. Bethany, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I want to ask the guest why, when they talk about budget cuts, are they not talking about cutting Defense Department, State Department, and all those sacred cows that are going to foreign governments that are actually enemy states instead of helping the American people first and then worrying about people overseas that there may not be allies?
Well, I mean, Defense Department is out there not exactly with a big hug for everybody. We've got a lot of weapons out in the world. Would you cut the defense spending? Some of that is in here, Bethany.
We spend more money on defense than the next eight countries combined in the world. So why is our budget so big when we're not doing anything or any real good in the world? We're giving states money not to shoot at us. Why?
Bethany, we'll pick it up. Here's another on that front online from Rick. He says, look, with a different perspective, says, with China in the ascent and rapidly so, and Putin et al. Wanting to reinvent the Russian bear, this is the time you want to cut the military? He calls that the epitome of naivete. Steve Pearlstein, what about the cuts to the enormous U.S. defense budget? Do they look substantial? Will they really change our military readiness?
You know, they will. You know, obviously, if you cut the defense budget seriously, which, by the way, the commission does do, are we going to have as many toys for them to play with? Are we going to have as many men and women in arms? No, we would not. But there's a lot of money that's, you might say, at the margin is not very beneficial there. And as the caller points out, who is it that we're going to fight? It's not as if everyone else is arming up. I mean, we obviously have to be concerned about the Chinese, but we are also fighting a lot of wars that we probably need not be fighting and we won't be fighting in the future, we all hope. And so, you know, there's plenty of, believe me, if you had to go any one place in the federal government to find money that was not being well spent, the first stop on my tour would be the Pentagon.
Diana, what's your conservative perspective on this? Conservatives had long supported defense spending. On the other hand, we've got a real fiscal problem here. The scale of cuts in this plan, do you think it's all right?
Well, I think that suddenly one would have to be blind to say that you cannot get any cuts out of the Defense Department. The way the funds are allocated, sometimes on the basis of what congressional district weapon happens to be made in, we could make a lot better use. We could outsource some of the services. What's important is that our military have all the equipment that they need. We are fighting serious wars in Afghanistan. We're in Iraq. They need to have everything, the best that they have, that they can use. But we could, I think, do that in a more efficient way. So I think, yes, there are room for cuts in the Department of Defense budget.
Let's go to John in Westerly, Rhode Island. John, you're on the air.
Hi, and thank you for taking the call. Mm-hmm. First of all, I want to thank you. This is a great subject. But I disagree with people on all sides. I would vote in favor of this compromise, this commission. I think it makes a lot of sense. I think the timing is right because we see European countries in trouble and we see them making tough decisions, and I think the American people are ready to make tough decisions. And Bob made a point earlier in that government spending somehow led to 25 years of growth after World War II. I have to disagree with that. I'm a historian, and it was an aberration. The rest of the world was in ruins at that time. The United States had the only industrialized economy, Australia mm-hmm. and very small, and Canada were the only countries really untouched by the war. So those present challenges. The other challenge, Diane makes excellent points, but I've got to say at some point we have to pay for everything. We have to generate some income, and I think tax reform plays an important part of this. I think that what we hear for tax rates aren't the real tax rates. I am a small businessman. I know what my accountant goes through. The tax code is much too complicated. Wealthy people aren't paying their fair share because of the tax code. And I think that reform piece that is put out by the commission plays an important part.
John, let me ask you, are you worried about this country going the way of Ireland, Greece, or do you think we're in a different situation?
I think we are in a different situation. As I said, I'm a historian. Empires typically fall not from external conquest, okay, but from economic crisis. Rome fell, I don't mean to say that we're an empire like in a traditional sense.
Yeah, yeah.
We are not, but we are in fact a very large country, and we are trying to learn how to, in fact, let go of some of the power. In other words, China's ascending, India's ascending. There needs to be room at the table for everyone without a lot of elbowing going around. And elbowing on a global scale means people dying, means wars being fought, and resources wasted.
Of course, we need to mind how we're doing in that shared table at the same time, I guess. John, mm-hmm. I really appreciate your call. Bob Kuttner, let me put to you, this point. John's a historian. He says we're in economic crisis. You've got a plan that you'd prefer to have in here, but if we've got a crisis and there's a Republican Congress coming in that is almost, there's no way in Hades they're going to adopt the plan you've put out there, I suppose. Is there a point at which you say, this isn't what I want at all, but the crisis is so big that this is better than nothing, and so we do this? Or, when the Congress is stacked against you coming up, Bob?
Well, I actually think it's worse than nothing in the sense that austerity makes a depression or a recession worse. And the Republicans have gained ascendancy not by saying, the Democrats are in power, so we just better fold our hands and split mm-hmm. the difference. The Republicans have gained ascendancy by being clear about what they stand for and by being tough as nails. And I wish my Democratic friends were a little tougher.
But they have 2 years of majority in the House now,
yeah.
And those are pretty important years. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but can the country, wait while the Democrats, nail up, tough as nail up, over those years, if that's what they were going to do, for a different vote?
I think premature belt tightening is much, much worse than nothing because it would sandbag the economy. And I would rather see President Obama take a leaf from Harry Truman's book and say this is the way to fix the economy with more investment in people, more investment in America's future, and dare the Republicans to vote against it and make 2012 be a referendum on that. My fear is that he won't do it, and I would really encourage your listeners to look at the official proposal, look at our proposal at ourfiscalsecurity.org, and compare which one is rooted in reality, which one stands a better chance of promoting an economic recovery.
Diana?
And deficit reduction, by the way, because both plans, the one thing they have in common is they both lead to a lot of deficit reduction. The difference is, do you do it with growth and jobs, or do you do it with austerity and belt tightening?
I'll bring that to you, Diana.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Stephen, please.
Okay, Bob, so let's imagine that the commission tomorrow says we are going to delay everything in our report for 4 years or 3 years, and during those 3 years, we would do investment spending of $100 billion in each year. If that were the case, would you vote for the plan? Because you're trying to say we can't. This is not this is not an issue now. What's issue is our depression. We need to get out of it. So let's imagine that we do a reasonable amount of stimulus, and we just delay this austerity, as you call it. Would you be voting for the plan?
With one slight exception, and Steve, you're asking exactly the right question. If you get the timing right and the stimulus right, then the question is, what's the mix of tax increases and spending cuts? And I think they have the balance wrong. of 70% spending cuts. I mean, domestic spending, not counting the stimulus, which was an emergency measure, is at its lowest level relative to GDP in about 60 years. So if we can change it so more increases on the top 2% taxes and less spending cuts, yes, then I'd vote for it.
Diana, what about the argument that austerity will sink the economy, not clear the decks for it to grow? What do you say to that?
Well, I don't think that we should have austerity. We should look at prosperity and opportunity, and that's what Paul Ryan's Roadmap for America's Future does. The Commission proposal for deficit reduction isn't the only one on the table. We need to focus on what do we have to do to create jobs. I came from England. The wonderful thing about America was that anyone could get a job. My fellow students went on unemployment benefit during the summer. I came back here and got a summer job. Now the teen unemployment rate is 26%, and that means no first foot on the first rung.
But pick up the argument. I mean, Bob Kuttner is saying straight into the face of that argument that this, and I assume you'd say the same about Paul Ryan's plan, these are austerity plans, and they will sink the economy, not bring the prosperity that you say should be there. But it's not, and he's saying austerity won't help it come. What do you say to that argument?
I say that there's plenty of room for cuts in many of the areas that the Commission has made, and there's many more cuts that could be made also.
And how will those revive the economy?
And if you look at they'll revive the economy by giving the private sector more money to do things with, and it's entrepreneurs that create jobs, not the government.
But it's sitting on a pile of money right now, is it not?
And to look at the Social Security, well, yeah, but there's so much uncertainty. If you don't know what your tax rate's going to be January 1st, if you know that if you hire a worker above 50 workers, you're going to get a penalty of $2,000 per year for every worker that you have, you're not going to be hiring more workers. And in terms of Social Security cuts that Bob was talking about, the Social Security program, the benefits that individuals get in total, are expanding along with their life expectancies. If anything, we should raise the retirement age further than 1 year over every 40. And there are a lot of people such as myself who would be glad to say that we have a higher retirement age, or we could allow people to choose higher benefits in terms in exchange for, say, retiring at 70 or 75. Many people would be glad to make that choice.
Bob, Steve, I'll put that to you. Let me get Tate in Berea, Kentucky. Tate, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. I have two quick comments and one question. One, I don't understand the obsession with taxes. It seems to me if you are paying taxes, it means that you have an income. And I'm far more concerned about the people who don't have any income at the moment due to unemployment. And also, I totally agree with your guest, Bob. And my question is for Diana. I would like an example of when, historically, cutting taxes for wealthy people has resulted in job creation, because we've just come out of 8 years of the Bush administration and his tax cuts. Reagan cut taxes, and we didn't hit our true stride of prosperity until Bill Clinton came into office and began to raise some of them back up again.
Our time is short. Diana, what do you say to Tate in Kentucky?
I would say the tax cuts of John F. Kennedy, of President Reagan, of President George W. Bush all resulted in periods of growth and low unemployment rates. And many people look back on the unemployment rates in the Bush era of around 5% with nostalgia.
Bob, you're looking at higher rates in your plan for more affluent, wealthier Americans. Is that inconsistent with job growth?
Not at all, because if you raise taxes on wealthy people, very wealthy people tend to save most of what they make, and you take that money and spend 100 cents on the dollar in investments. A lot of that, by the way, goes right back into the private sector, because a lot of these public investments have private contractors. I just want to underscore one thing Diana said. I'm sure she said it. She said, mandate that women not work.
We took that facetiously.
Now, yeah, well, facetiously, because if we're talking about distributions in income, if you look at the top income quintile, one characteristic is that they have two earners. If you look at the bottom, it has half an earner per household. The top income quintile has two. Well, I'm just saying that if you're concerned about income inequality, then one thing to do is get fewer earners per household.
But I assume you're offering that as an explanation, not a prescription, Diana.
Right. I'm offering it as an explanation. I'm saying that getting rid of inequality shouldn't be our goal. We could have a perfectly equal society if we all moved, say, to Haiti or Cuba, but we would all be equally poor. We need to focus on job mobility, how to get people into jobs, how to keep them progressing up up the job ladder, up the income stream.
Bob and Steve, quickly, Bob, do you think anything's actually going to happen in this next, let's say, year on the deficit front, big picture, or do we stay paralyzed?
Well, I hope we move to a strategy of investing in the economy and, as Steve and I seem to agree, get the sequencing right, get the recovery going first, then do some heroic deficit reduction based on a stronger economy with more people paying taxes and prosperity returning. I certainly hope this commission stays deadlocked. Then maybe we can get some sensible strategies of reducing the deficit over time by increasing growth.
Steve, how long do we have? Is this dust in the wind? Does nothing happen out of all this, you know, talk and concern, or do you see something coming of it?
Something will come of it. I don't know how big. I think the politics of deficit reduction has changed. The public is concerned about it. Sometimes the public's concerned about it in a way that actually is not useful. For example, the public thinks that the deficit has something to do with causing high unemployment and the recession, and of course it doesn't. But people are fixated on it. It's become sort of a political fetish, and I don't think it'll go away right away. This is not a blue ribbon commission that's going to go on the shelf with all the others and be forgotten.
Well, wow. There is a lot of concern.
Right. We need economic growth, low taxes, certainty, and business-friendly environment for job creation to get Americans back to work.
There's the range of prescriptions and the commission's plan sitting right in the middle of it. A lot of American concern around it. I hope we've got some valuable perspective here today. I think we do. Diana Furstcott-Roth, former head of the Council of Economic Advisors for President George W. Bush, fellow at the Manhattan Institute, the Hudson Institute. Diana, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Bob Cutner at the American Prospect, thank you for your time today very much.
Great discussion as always. Thank you.
And Steve Perlstein at the Washington Post. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.